is not accounting for.
Exactly.
Stand up.
Exactly. Stand up. And
this is Radio Free Thinker, and we're going to start off with a little Peter Gunn.
And welcome to Radio Free Thinker on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, you're a free-thinking historian.
And I'm Don, you're a philosopher of political science.
I'm Rob, a cognitive psychologist and proud son. Today is my parents' 25th anniversary. Happy anniversary, Mom and Dad.
Way to go. So what's new in the world of science?
So we have three quick stories this time. We have one story from, let's see, this was published in the latest issue of Science and also reported in a variety of different news sources, Wired Science, New York Times. A couple of researchers at the University of Washington have cured congenital colorblindness in male squirrel monkeys. Cured is a sort of strong word for it because all male squirrel monkeys are born with red-green colorblindness. So they suggest the term enhanced. But basically they used gene therapy to put in a gene that creates L-opsin, which is the gene that is responsible for putting red pigmented cones into the retina.
I understand that one of the big questions that this answered wasn't so much whether they could do the genetics about it, but monkeys, these particular squirrel monkeys, didn't have any of the other hardware, if I remember the article quoted first, to interpret what this color would be or any of the other things. And it was amazing how the brain adapted to this completely alien sort of technology in its head. Now.
Yeah, a very, very, very good, example of how plastic the brain is. And what they did was they gave the monkeys these Ishihara color tests. You've probably seen them, like these splotches of green and red dots where you're supposed to pick out a number or something like that in them. They created them as a touch screen. And normally the monkeys would just grope around blindly, colorblindly, until they found the button that gave them food or juice and would keep pushing it. When they gave the monkeys the gene therapy and gave them the gene for L-opsin, they would immediately go for the red buttons, as they were trained to do, and this has stayed for, 2 months, 2 years after the treatment.
You know, this actually also shows, too, is the way one aspect of evolution works. I mean, in the wild, there are no red bananas. At least I don't think there are any red bananas, although there may be in some parts of the world. I shouldn't speak too loudly. But I've
seen some purple ones.
But there's an adaptation. So mammals in general will have a variation of colorblindness depending on what suits them. And obviously here's one example where evolution said you didn't need it, but you still had the same basic background mechanics to do with it.
Exactly.
So
it was common. It was still within the genetic code to handle the L-opsin gene. It just, the way they had evolved, it was shut off or not present. Another study, this is a great headline, dead salmon can think about human emotions. obviously it's a little tongue-in-cheek, but this one researcher, who is now, I believe, a grad student at UC Santa Barbara, took an Atlantic salmon, dead one, stuck it in an fMRI machine, and showed it a series of pictures of people and asked it to think about what emotion they might be experiencing while taking fMRI scans. And he found statistically significant results of brain activity in the salmon's brain when it was thinking about other people's emotions.
Jumping Jesus on a pogo stick. You mean salmon have souls?
No. He did this as a very strong illustration of the dangers of not doing very careful statistics with your fMRI data. When you do a scan, you get up to 130,000 voxels, three-dimensional pixels, of information about, you know, activity within the brain. And the natural noise of the fMRI process will lead to some false positives. And the way that the grad student described it was, if you take 130,000 darts and toss them all at once at a dartboard, some of them are going to hit the bullseye. That doesn't mean there was any significant, you know, skill involved in hitting the bullseye, and it doesn't mean that there was any significant activity in the brain going on when you see it on the fMRI scanner. It's just noise.
Because that just goes to show that you need to have qualified experts at these machines so that we get accurate readings and we don't just get salmon that think.
And this is, yeah, you need to be aware of what statistical analyses are actually telling you and not draw conclusions further than what you've seen.
What is fMRI?
A functional magnetic resonance imaging. It basically works by vibrating the molecules in your brain cells with magnetic fields and reading up. And we have one more story. In researchers, anthropologists investigating a cave in the Republic of Georgia discovered a dyed piece of twine made of flax. Using radiocarbon dating of stuff around the area, they discovered that it's about 30,000 years ago in the Upper Paleolithic, the same period in which cave painting flourished. So, you know, this is sort of the beginnings. We're looking at the beginnings of the evolution of culture, the birth of fashion as well as art.
I thought it was quite funny when I read an article or heard about the article. They said it was interesting. They said this was beyond the needle in a haystack sort of thing. This was a hay and a needle.
Yeah, these are extremely rare finds.
Well, and the only reason why I believe they found it was that they were doing dating on the seeds that were in this cave to find out what time period it was. And when they were looking at the seeds, they said, hey, this doesn't look like a seed. What is it? But I also noticed that it's colored. Why would they have them colored, do you think?
Well, that's something for people to look at. It's sort of the evolution of culture, the evolution of behavior and thought, which we'll talk more about when we come back after the break.
Yeah, this is Mickey Fitz in the business. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Keep the faith.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker with our roving reporter, Elon, who's going to be talking about evolutionary psychology.
Hi, everybody. Before I start, I wanted to quickly say your last couple of episodes about Scientology, amazing. I've really been a big fan of the show since I've left, which I hope doesn't say anything about me. But anyway, today I was hoping to talk about some evolutionary psychology. So I plan to basically introduce what this concept is and then tell you a few cool results. Well, we could all agree, hopefully, if you can't agree on this, then sort of this is out of the scope of something we could talk about. But we should all agree that evolution is a fact. Species change over time through descent with modification from a common ancestor, and its natural selection is sort of the cause that decides what features are going to be passed along throughout time. And there's a mountain of evidence for evolution. There's no alternative interpretation. So we could all agree that at least our physical characteristics have evolved over time.
So evolution exists.
Evolution
exists. What does this have to do with psychology?
So if we could agree with that, then the thing is, for some reason, though everyone's pretty happy to agree for the most part that our physical characteristics, such as our height or number of fingers or whatever sort of physical things we have, people will agree that was affected by evolution. People find it hard to believe that the way we think has also evolved over time due to selective pressures. Though really, our brain is just another part of our body that has been affected by life and trying to survive. So that evolutionary psychology goes to try to figure out why we think the way we think and why you know, all the things about our brain and our psychology and how that came about due to evolution.
Doesn't this presuppose, though, a particular materialistic view of the mind? I mean, you're kind of hinting at that, I guess, that we are physical bodies and that's all there is to us and that there is no immaterial part to our psyche.
I think that is one of the major assumptions of modern psychology, that basically there's this sort of model that it's neurophysiology of the brain, and this gives rise to cognitive processes, and this gives rise to our thoughts and behaviors, that there's no extra stuff being added, that it's sort of based in material things.
Right, exactly. And you could think, if you know, once you die, if you believe that there's still something going on, then obviously you can't really apply these facts from evolutionary psychology, because there's nothing that's really being passed along. Your soul lives forever. But if we could assume that our brain is a physical thing and it affects how we act, then we could have this discussion. I was thinking maybe to introduce evolutionary psychology, I'll bring up a really simple example of how our psychology must have evolved over time. So consider feces, which is always a fun topic to discuss. I think that most of you would agree that feces is pretty gross. We as humans don't enjoy being around it. We would be absolutely appalled at the thought of eating it. Are you guys with me on this?
Yes.
Yeah.
So there you go. But the interesting thing is, not all animals are disgusted by feces. So you can think of dung beetles, that their life is in feces, rolling around, having a good time. So you could think there must be something about the way that we react to feces that's different than other animals. And the thing is, humans, it is dangerous for us to be near feces and to eat feces. It contains lots of bacteria, pathogens. So if you could imagine that there was a mutant human a long time ago who really enjoyed the taste and smell of feces, this person would likely get sick and die long before he had a chance to pass along his feces-loving genes. And so you could sort of think of it as this is an adaptive pressure. Like those who want to stay as far away from feces as possible have a better chance of reproducing. And therefore, this piece of psychology is the one that's now rampant throughout the human population.
But isn't that a little bit of sort of the chicken or the egg kind of idea here?
Yeah, I mean, it fits really, really well into the framework. But is it providing support for the framework, or is it the other way around?
Because I think that, you know, like the dung beetle doesn't know it's hanging out in feces. It doesn't have a concept of disgust at all, right? I mean,
I think actually a better example here might be the dog. Because I think, I mean, for one, a dung beetle doesn't play with its own dung. It plays with the dung of another animal.
Mm-hmm.
But a dog eats its own feces and the feces of other dogs.
Well, I don't know if do all dogs do that, or is that just sort of a rare thing that dogs do? I know that they seem to like the smell of feces, but isn't that because they're not smelling it as, say, when we smell it, they're smelling for like hormones and scents and...
Well, that's the thing. Like the smell of feces isn't inherently smelly. You know, it's our brains have evolved to tell us that this smell is bad because it's dangerous for humans to eat. Or maybe for other animals, it's not, you know, it's not as dangerous, and therefore their brains didn't have this pressure to find it so gross.
But didn't like early humans use dung to like build things and burn fires and stuff like that?
Some exactly, still do.
Like cow and horse manure is a good thing for one, fertilizer, B, for making cement for walls. I mean, not quite cement, but a form of cement.
So I guess you guys have got me there in terms of, like, I don't know, there must be some, like, with fertilizer and stuff, they must treat it to take away the smell. But the question of why we find it abhorrent to smell in the first place, this was just an example of how that could be explained using evolutionary psychology, that we maybe evolved not to...
I think the idea is that evolutionary psychology is a sort of a framework in which to put psychological experiments. You can make experiments in some other framework, like, you know, testing basic intuitions about mind or folk psychology. With evolutionary psychology, you construct your experiments to test these theories that these behaviors and these thought processes evolved as an adaptation.
Right. Well, I think actually this sort of discussion brings up a good point, that one of the reasons why evolutionary psychology is sort of I wouldn't say a fringe thing, but sort of a more controversial part of science, is because it's very hard. You know, like you could come up with a really good sort of story of how something could have evolved, like my example of feces. A cool example of another cool example of evolutionary psychology is incest avoidance. So I guess just like feces avoidance. Now we can talk about almost all, but this doesn't only go for humans. Pretty much almost all animals don't mate with their close relatives, their parents or their siblings. You know, you could ask you could ask the listeners, you know, like consider having safe sex with one of your siblings. you know, if you think about it logically, there's no real tangible risks to this. You know, if you're not going to get pregnant, there's no. But for some reason, we still consider this to be detestable. We've come to learn that if you have offspring with a close blood relative, that will increase your chance of having the recessive genetic disorders. So if your parents had a recessive genetic disorder, you get it and your sibling gets it, it's very unlikely you'll pass it on to your children because your partner is unlikely to have this disorder. Except if you mate with your siblings, you have a better chance of passing along these recessives. And this genetic threat drops geometrically with the degrees of relatedness. So the siblings and parents, you know, your close relatives, that's where it's a risk. And that's why you could see sort of first cousin marriages are a lot more common than sibling marriages. So basically, this is another thing that we could start to study. You know, this brings up a hypothesis. You could say we would think that we've evolved to avoid having relations or being attractive to our close kin because this could lead to genetic problems with our children.
It's kind of like evolutionary psychology is sort of a hypothesis generator. You see some behavior that humans exhibit, like incest avoidance, and you come up with the evolutionary explanation that we're doing this because it is evolutionarily maladaptive to mate with your siblings. And then you have to construct experiments to support this hypothesis. And that's where I think evolutionary psychology runs into problems, because it's really hard to test these kinds of claims.
Not that I'm disagreeing with that idea, but isn't it more logical to say that we've evolved a problem-solving mind as opposed to evolutionary adaptive psychological opinions on incest? That we've simply evolved the ability to recognize cause and effect, and that doing a certain thing will have a bad effect as opposed to...
So, Ethan, I would tend to disagree with that just because it's not only humans who don't mate with their siblings. It's pretty much like almost a lot, well, I can't say all, but most of the animal kingdom, they tend to mate not with their close relatives. So it must be some sort of hardwired trait.
But, I mean, animals evolve too. There's no reason to assume
exactly.
That they don't,
so it's not that
they wouldn't have the same kind of problem-solving brain as that we do.
Really, it's just like we just have this feeling, innate feeling in us that, like, yuck, it's gross. You know what I mean? It's not like we're trying to solve the problem of having... Because, again, I brought up that point of having... If you were to have safe sex with a condom or oral sex, you know, it's not dangerous, but still, you know, we
find
it gross.
But even if you look back in time before even, you know, safe sex existed, it was often stigmatized that, you know, the offspring of two siblings were often going to be, you know, grow up to be rapists or malcontents or evil people. That was always built into sort of human anthropology. So I'm not saying that it's like we have to learn it. I'm just saying that I think that it's not so much we have this built-in code in our brain that makes us feel icky about incest, but it's sort of a socialized, long-term, passed-down feeling, not so much by evolution, but just by cause and effect.
I think, Ethan, I mean, we are animals, and we have behaviors. And we see that a lot in other animals. And we say that animals go out at night because there's food. It's not like they sit there and say, oh, it's dark out. It's something that they've been programmed. There's the hibernating patterns of animals are evolutionary. It's not like they sit there and they say, listen, I got a clock, I got to get up now because of a thought process. It's built into their psychology. Same thing can happen with humans. I mean, I agree. I don't think everything humans do is necessarily driven by evolution. But I think a lot of what we do, or at least what's behind the scenes is. But a lot of the problems we're having here is, unlike physical adaptations, which I think we all agree happen, evolutionarily speaking, how do we go back to Neanderthal type times, to, you know, Homo erectus, and look at his culture and see what things have evolved over time from there? Because we just don't have the information. One of the cool things about writing and now with video is 1,000 years from now, people might be able to actually do an assessment of how we've changed evolutionarily, psychologically speaking, because there is the data there to work with.
That's right, Don. Yeah, like there's no fossil record of our brains, unfortunately. But there are some cool experiments that have been done in this incest avoidance, which is why I wanted to bring it up. So, like, I guess when you think of it, the really interesting question might be, how did our ancestors, like, if we assume that we do have this incest avoidance trait, which might be controversial in its own right, but if we say, if we do have it, how did our ancestors evolve this trait? Like, if we're talking about primitive, you know, primitive ancestors that didn't talk, like, they don't know, like, you know, oh, this is your sister, this is your brother. So how do they know who was a close relative and who wasn't in order to know who to mate with? So one theory is that we've evolved a heuristic to not be sexually interested in those we have had individual, intensive, extended exposure with during childhood. And this theory is called the Westermark effect. So sort of like you abhor the idea of having sex with your sister because you've grown up with her. So sort of like that was the way the brain was able to figure out this is a person that you should detest the idea of having sex with. And the evidence, there is some evidence for this Westermark effect, and it's called, it's from these Taiwanese minor marriages. So apparently in Taiwan, they did this thing for a while called minor marriages where the children were betrothed early in childhood. So the bride entered the future husband's household as a child, and they actually grew up together, even though they weren't siblings. But they were raised as siblings, and these minor marriages were problematic in terms of there was a lack of sexual interest, low fertility, more infidelity, more divorce. These marriages ended up not being as successful as regular marriages, which might be some evidence for this Westermark effect. You could think of it as our brains needing to figure out a solution where you won't mate, the people who mate with their close kin are going to have less chance of surviving. So we need to sort of have a way to not mate with our close kin.
And the idea is that the more different someone is, the more attractive they are, because genetically there's greater diversity and greater strength.
I think that the idea of these automatic heuristics, these low-level automatic behaviors that we that sort of happen automatically in the brain that direct our behavior, there's a lot of evidence for them in psychology and cognitive psychology, especially that there's a lot of these behaviors that are not necessarily learned. They're sort of hard-coded or unlocked with some particular environmental stimulus. It's not a high-level process. It's a low-level process, an unconscious heuristic, which gives rise to high-level processing.
Okay, well, yeah, that's a really good point, Rob, and I think it's really interesting. And, like, you know, the idea is that evolution doesn't work where there wasn't anyone saying, you know, that people shouldn't mate with their close relatives, right? It's just that there were some that would, let's say, mate with those who they grew up with, and those ones would end up having less successful offspring as opposed to those who didn't. So those who didn't want to mate with those close relatives are the ones that will proliferate more. There was no ever idea that it had to do with incest, at least according to this theory. So you're right, these low-level things could lead to high-level results.
Elon, we've sort of gone through this, and I think we've talked a lot about a lot of different things, and it seems to be an appropriate area for at least more science discovery. Has anyone ever pointed out pitfalls where this science could be used for not good?
Humans have different cultural markers or physical markers. So physical markers, such as, say, skin color or the way they look, but also cultural markers, such as how they dress, you know, how the ornaments, our dialects, language, greetings, foods. And we tend to make general assumptions sometimes about people, you know, stereotyping based on these markers. And this might have an evolutionary psychology background just because, you know, we've evolved to try to find generalities in groups.
Well, it sounds like we could go on and on and on about what evolutionary psychology perhaps offers in terms of ambiguous moral and racial questions. Maybe we should wrap up right now. So any closing comments, Elon, about where we could get some more information on evolutionary psychology?
Yes. So the reason why I got interested in this is I took a course at UBC, Psych 358. So if you're at UBC, I definitely recommend taking it. It's called Evolutionary Psychology. If you're at UBC, I say take Psych 358 because it was a really interesting course.
Well, excellent. Anyone else have some great sources, perhaps?
I have a quote. It's from the paper by Cosmides and Tooby. And Cosmides and Tooby are two researchers that do a lot of work in evolutionary psychology, especially as it relates to cognitive psychology. So look them up. And this is a quote from Theodosius Dobzhansky. "Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution." Something to think about.
Wow, excellent.
Well, thanks again for having me on, guys. I look forward to coming back soon.
And we'll be right back after this.
Now's the time for Age of Humans. Care for what can be done for yourself.
Promoting their latest album in the ever-expanding universe, the Biltmore Cabaret and the Georgia Strait present Canadian band The Most Serene Republic with Seattle's Grand Archives. They're playing the Biltmore Cabaret on Saturday, September 26th. Doors at 7, show at 8:30. Tickets are on sale now.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker, so thanks, Elon, for joining us on that conversation. Now let's talk a little bit about the Georgia Strait. So, Rob, what did they publish recently?
Recently, and I found out about this from Some Canadian Skeptic. It's a blog.
That's actually his name, somecanadianskeptics.com. Recommend our listeners check it out.
This person, Sonia McLeod, published an article in the Georgia Strait this past week. The headline, Homeopathy Offers an Alternative for the Flu. And she starts with an anecdote and talks about, you know, my kids will not be getting either the swine flu shot or the regular flu shot this year. Thanks to long-term constitutional homeopathic treatment, my kids have strong immunity. Now, for those of you who are just tuning into our show for the first time, homeopathy is basically water.
How does that principle work, Robert?
The idea behind homeopathy is that you take something that causes the same symptoms.
Sympathetic magic sort of idea.
Yeah, the cause of the same symptoms that you're trying to cure, and then dilute it a fucking hell of a lot, so much so that by all the known laws of chemistry, there is actually not a trace of it left. It's just water.
And it's supposed to work because the water remembers that it used to be associated
yeah,
with
yeah, people
this?
Talk about the water having memory or something like that.
Well, she does actually reference a few studies, which we looked up and we found to be severely lacking in the scientific method.
Yeah, there's a... they sort of end their own study with the quote, it would be unwise to claim that the study has demonstrated a cause and effect relationship between the drug and the recoveries.
From what I understand, the study suffered from a small size, and the actual
the difference
of improvement
was small.
Was so small.
Not only that, but I looked up this. She talks about using oscillococcinium as it's a common, very common homeopathic treatment for the flu. It's made out of a diluted liver and heart of a Barbary duck made up by some guy in 1925, and it's big business.
Yes, sort of big faux pharma.
Yes. And there are two studies in the entirety of everything that I could look up that are, and I put this in quotation marks, support homeopathic remedies.
I think there are two very important things here to go with what Robert's saying. I mean, one, we already had this earlier mention about the salmon and how statistics can prove almost anything if you give them the right thing. So if there is a slight statistical variation and some of them say that this might or may not be beneficial, the really smallness of it can be really, really misleading. Also the fact that there's not a lot of studies. If anyone remembers back in the 60s and 70s, there was a lot of research done into ESP and all that. They did the research and it turned out there was nothing there. So people haven't done research into it since, because there's no longer a justification for it. So a lot of the absence of studies on this isn't that they're trying to hide it, but maybe there's nothing there worth studying.
Well, yeah, I will post this up to my blog later, but there's this one person that critically analyzes the particular study that Sonia refers to in the article, and basically concludes and shows that no one has replicated the results. No one has done follow-up studies to this because, you know, homeopathic remedies cannot, in principle, work.
Have been done by homeopaths. You know, it's a conflict of interest. These practitioners are going out to prove homeopathy works. What that means is they're going to pick and choose which evidence they accept. They're stacking the deck in their favor. And science does not approach a problem like this. They consider all the evidence, and they don't make up their mind until after they've reviewed all the evidence.
Unless the Republicans.
Well, there's a good political plug there.
But, you know, I think part of what we're getting at, too, is we're not only upset with homeopathy, because obviously we've covered the topic before.
We're upset with the Georgia Strait.
Exactly. Yeah, there are some huge problems right now. For listeners who don't know, Sonia McLeod is the daughter of the paper's owner. She's a practicing homeopath who sells her own treatments for about $120. It's a major conflict of interest.
Like a huge conflict of interest. I think, you know, I was talking with someone at Skeptics in the Pub a couple months ago, and he was telling me about how people actually, the editor shut off commenting on one of Sonia's articles. And this is something that you do not do.
There's actually a disclaimer on her articles. I'm not sure if the Georgia Strait has other disclaimers on their articles, but
it's the only one I've seen.
Yeah.
But, I mean, she's published something about homeopathic remedies in the summer for bee stings. She's published things about, you know, that are favorable to naturopathy, to acupuncture.
Well, I'd like to point out that the source Rob mentioned earlier, somecanadianskeptic.com, has some great blog entries about this. And in fact, in one of them references the BC Press Council, where you can complain about poor quality reporting. I recommend our listeners check that out, and it'll be in our show notes. This is a problem that's been going on for a while now, and we really need to send a message that we're not interested in dangerous, bad reporting on by our news sources.
You know, I find very conflict here, myself conflicted, because I like the Georgia Strait. I mean, as someone who's on the left, the Georgia Strait quite often does bring information, but there is an idea of being too open. I mean, we were joking around before about there are many different open ideas out there, but some of them are just wrong and dangerous. This sort of thing, I mean, if you don't get flu shots for little children or the elderly, they die. How can you be open to something that kills people?
So it's the sort of thing where, like, actual flu treatments, even if this one article, you know, this one journal article shows that homeopathy is effective, actual flu treatments are far more effective.
Right. Well, we're pretty much out of time, so I'd like to remind our listeners to check out Skeptics in the Pub on September 29th, 7:30, the Railway Club. Also, the UBC Freethinkers are putting on a movie night, September 30th, Life of Brian. Check it out.
I wanted to bring up something for our skeptic highlight, something that people should check into. Everyone may or may not know, I'm originally from Manitoba, and quite recently the Greyhound has threatened to cut off all service to Manitoba and Northern Ontario because of quote-unquote economic issues. I think it's something very interesting to check out, that it will no longer be possible for you to go from Vancouver to Toronto by bus in the future because the bus companies aren't getting money from the government. That's just something I think you should look into this week.
And this is Rob, the cognitive psychologist. Just reminding you once again that you should come to Skeptics in the Pub. It's next week after the show. Once again, happy anniversary to my parents.
Okay, goodbye, everybody.
Big government and big pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy, in which secret government contracts are sold to big pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so big pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education, every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Now's the time for Age of Humans Care for what can be done for yourself.
Promoting their latest album in the ever-expanding universe, the Biltmore Cabaret and the Georgia Strait present Canadian band The Most Serene Republic with Seattle's Grand Archives. They're playing the Biltmore Cabaret on Saturday, September 26th. Doors at 7, show at 8:30. Tickets are on sale now.